Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And welcome to Carol Coach. Hey, this is Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and I am here talking with you about sexual addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder, and any other malady that you may be feeling as a result of addictive behavior. I feel so fortunate tonight because I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Boriskin, who actually works at the Meadows specifically with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I know you may wonder and ask yourself, you know, what is post-traumatic stress and how would I know if I had it? And so we're going to be talking with Dr. and we're going to be trying to figure out, could you have experienced something in your childhood that has led to traumatic reenactment, traumatic stress responses? You know, it can be very, very difficult if you're not geared towards clinical issues to know what heart palpitations mean, flashbacks, and not trusting, and many of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And so, again, we're really fortunate to have one of the premier doctors on to talk about this issue. And clearly, the Meadows is obviously one of the most important treatment centers in the United States for helping people with drug and alcohol addiction. And I know that I send all of my clients to the Meadows to get help with sex addiction because they really have one of the best facilities in the United States. So we are so happy to be working with them. And I write a blog for them on sexual addiction. And it's just very important to have healthy residential treatment programs available for you, and they're willing to work with you at any point. So I'm really looking forward to talking with Dr. Boriskin. And if you wonder whether you have a sexual addiction and you want to know more about your symptoms, you can always email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. I am available for consultation to get you referred to the right service, to the right program, to the right facility. You name it, I am more than happy to do that for you. So I clearly want to be that guide for you so that we can definitely work together to get you the help that you desire. So as I am waiting for Dr. Jerry Boreskin to call in, he is going to be calling in here in about 8 minutes, I want to talk to you a little bit about what are the symptoms of sexual addiction. You know, there's been some hype in the media, specifically on the Dr. Phil show, where there have been different PhDs and MDs that questioned whether sexual addiction really is a full-fledged diagnosis. And I know if you're like the majority of the public, you too have probably said, isn't that just bad behavior? Well, so much of addiction, when we're talking process addictions, that's eating disorders, that's gambling, that's sex, have to do with out-of-control compulsive behavior. And I can't highlight enough how important it is for you to know that there are people that absolutely cannot stop their behavior, no matter how hard they try. Literally, they are unable to control it. They've promised themselves a million times that they would. Maybe this sounds like you. I mean, have you told yourself, I am not going to look at pornography? Or I am absolutely going to stop cheating on my wife? Maybe you said, you know what? I am not going to massage parlors anymore. I absolutely am not going to spend another penny on prostitutes. And you meant that, whether that lasted for a minute, an hour, a day, a week, or a month. And then all of a sudden you went back to it again. And you felt worse about yourself because you broke your own sacred contract to yourself. Maybe you needed to drink to deal with the shame and the guilt, the sadness and the pain. Maybe you needed to use cocaine or marijuana or ecstasy. Oftentimes people will medicate with a substance to either get the courage up to experience the behavior they so desperately want and don't want, and other times they medicate afterwards because the feelings of shame and guilt are so extreme that they can't live with themselves. And so I'm here to tell you that when these two situations occur, the compulsivity and the feeling out of control, you have enough reason to say, okay, I probably need an assessment by a certified sexual addictions therapist. And what I really highly recommend is that you get on the website www.sexhelp.com and take the test that helps you to determine, do you have a problem? Now, that sounds so simple, doesn't it? And yet, at the same time, it's the start. It's the start of you getting healthy and figuring out what you need to do to make your life better. If you have a question for myself or Dr. Jerry Boreskin, or maybe you have a question about your own behaviors, you can give us a call at 646-595-3284 and know that we will absolutely handle it anonymously. You don't have to give your real name, and you don't even have to identify where you're from. You can just ask the question and know that you're in a safe place. The good news is, if you're listening to the show, you have some concerns about your own behavior, or you have some concerns about your partner, whether he be male or she be female, and you want more information and you want more education. You know, every week we try to ask the tough questions, and we work diligently to provide you information on subjects that are related to sexual addiction. As I said tonight, we're going to be interviewing Dr. Jerry Borskin, and he works at the Meadows, and he is an expert in PTSD. He's going to talk about how did he develop that expertise, what are the co-occurring addictions, who's at risk for developing this problem, what is it, and of course I'm going to want to know, is anybody immune to it? Certainly we've heard of post-traumatic stress disorder when we've talked to veterans in the community. We're dealing right now with a situation that is very tense close to Washington, D.C., with the shooting that's occurred at the naval base. I don't have any reason to believe that that's a veteran, although he certainly served in some capacity. We'll find out more as the news unveils. But, you know, people that truly experience post-traumatic stress, whether it's because of a trauma they experienced as a kid, whether they were in the war, whether they experienced some sort of major crisis, they're at a higher risk for suicide, in part because they medicate, in part because they don't think it's ever going to get better. So as we talk about post-traumatic stress and we find out about how it affects people, its chronic and physical condition, and what to look for in good treatment. We're also going to do the invariable, and I'm telling you, we always ask our experts for resources in the community, books that can get you started in getting the help you need. So I'm really looking forward to talking with him. Now, I am so happy that in so many ways this show is gaining so much popularity because it means people are going to iTunes and they're going to Blog Talk Radio and they're looking up under the term of sexual addiction and they're finding the show. It saddens me that this is epidemic in proportion, but I also understand that it is something that can be managed. So I don't want you to give up hope, and I want you to know there are resources available, and we're going to be talking about those resources. Again, you can call the show at 646-595-3284 and know that we handle everything very confidentially. You are listening to Carol Jurgensen Cheats. I'm Carol the Coach, and we truly want to help you to work through any issues that you have surrounding addiction. So tonight I feel very fortunate to be interviewing Dr. Jerry Borskin, and he works at the Meadows. Dr. Borskin, is that you on the line?
Yes, it is.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to help us understand post-traumatic stress disorder, because a lot of the clients that I work with and a lot of our listeners have had questions about post-traumatic stress. And so I know you're an expert in the field. So can you explain a little bit to our listeners in simple terms, what is PTSD?
Okay, PTSD is something that a lot of people have heard of, many people can describe, yet it is somewhat elusive and difficult to define. And part of that has to do with the inner experience of each individual being slightly different and at the same time kind of universal in terms of similarity to patterns and symptoms. We didn't really understand what this phenomenon was 30 years ago. When I first started in this field, we kind of knew that traumatic events changed people. And what we now know is that traumatic events, either a single big traumatic episode or a series of sustained lesser traumas, result in a change that is multidimensional in its consequences. And it really changes the way people feel, think, interact with others, and their overall belief systems. So it's a powerful phenomenon. It's a game changer. And the odd thing is when you have it, you kind of know it, but at the same time, you might tend to deny it. And then at other times, it's something that makes you feel like you're separate, unique, crazy, or whatever. But it's really the simplest definition I know, and one that I think has a definite social merit, is it's a normal set of reactions to insane circumstances. And there's some technical problems with the definitions, and academics would pull it apart. But really, it kind of captures what the game-changing was when we first really put our focus upon events rather than personal shortcomings. So I like to look at it as what happens to an individual as a consequence of overwhelming trauma or circumstances that are unfair, unmanageable, uncontrollable.
Well, that makes total sense. Now, you mentioned huge trauma or a series of smaller traumas, and sometimes I know the experts in the field call that big T or little T traumas.
Right.
Can you give us some ideas of events that lead to post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, the easiest way to discuss that is to go back a little bit into the sequence of how our attention to post-traumatic stress disorder began and how it has evolved. When we first looked at the consequences of traumatic events on individuals, we really were looking at soldiers exclusively. And that's kind of an easy population to focus on, because I think anyone would agree that being in a war zone is not exactly a comfortable, controllable, safe environment. And those who are exposed to the chaos of war, a fairly large percentage of them, anywhere from the estimates vary from 18% to like 35%, and sometimes it's as high as 90%, depending upon what kind of unit you're in, you'll develop the symptoms that we call post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's kind of very simple in the early days. We really defined this as a result of the Vietnam War and some activism among veterans who had symptoms of something that had not been really honored or described in the literature, either politically or professionally or in any discussion, until they became active and asserting the powers that be to recognize that war changes people. Shortly after, this was actually 1979 when the Readjustment Counseling Act came into being, it was codified then by an act of Congress that veterans had something that we called by default at the time post-traumatic stress disorder. There were several names being considered for the phenomenon. But in 1980, it became part of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, third revision, where it became an official diagnosis. And then it was really focusing mostly on soldiers and sexual abuse survivors. Those are two populations that are kind of no-brainers. It's like, you know, someone who's been sexually assaulted, it's considered as horrific or worse in some instances than exposure to war trauma. But as the years went forward, we began to see that the definitions really fit other populations as well. In some instances, things as difficult to put your finger on as verbal abuse, depending upon age and family dynamics. Parents who've lost children in car accidents or unpredictable deaths, these are other population groups that got added in by researchers when they said, gee, you know what, we think many other populations with all kinds of sizes of T, big T, little T, in between, multiple cumulative T's, they all kind of produce the same series of symptoms. So in part, what we look at as diagnosticians and clinicians is not how you got there. That is not really the relevant criteria. The question is, do you have it? And if you have it, how do we help you transcend that? So from my vantage point, I don't really look at, it's not my job to evaluate whether it's a trauma, a single event, or a bunch of little events that cause these symptoms. Were you sufficiently feeling overpowered, out of control, and helpless, and abused by situations that created this sense of powerlessness, and also along with it is a sense of responsibility. That's one of the core features that we see with PTSD, is underneath a lot of the chaotic, contradictory symptoms, it is this sense that somehow I'm to blame for what went wrong. And you see this with small children who are exposed to traumatic events without any coaching or training, begin to make attributions that, gee, I caused this event, I caused mom and dad to get divorced, whereas you would look at the same family with an 18, 19-year-old, they'll have a more accurate attribution, saying, you know, Dad was an alcoholic, mom was codependent. They argued a lot. It was better that they separated, and they won't take personal responsibility. So age is a factor, as well as the nature of the trauma. There are many, many variables that come together that play a role in determining whether you get the syndrome or not. So it would be overly simplistic to only focus on the nature of the trauma, although by definition, we do have to have some parsing in terms of, you know, whether the event is just an ordinary event. Certainly getting a parking ticket would not create PTSD, but having a fatal car accident where you're the sole survivor would. So there are gradations, but it's not our job as clinicians necessarily sort the event out. It's looking at the damage, the sense of powerlessness, and then the core symptoms that I'll happily describe for you if you like in terms of, you know, just the checklist of things. And among the more classically derived symptoms are the sense of cognitive intrusion, when you become kind of obsessed with the event and have a hard time turning off some of that obsessive ideation. But what's interesting is some of that obsessive ideation could go underground and become quasi-conscious and you become not even aware. But what happens is it splits awareness so that you're always kind of obsessing about what's going on and have a hard time focusing, which is one of the reasons that we hear some of the comments from family members and significant others, like, you know, ever since such and such happened, it's like he or she is here but not here. That's because there's this quiet, obsessive attempt to resolve the unresolvable going on in the background or kind of semi, you know, remotely from awareness. And with that, there's some spikes of intrusion where certain triggers create this sense of it's happening again and it feels like you're reliving it in real time. That's another one of the hallmark symptoms of PTSD with PTSD. It's not like an ordinary memory. It's an intrusive memory that kind of displaces you from your grounding of where you are, who you are, and what state. So people who have PTSD have symptoms that make them feel like they're abnormal when they're not. It makes them feel like they're crazy, displaced, dissociative, if you will. And in fact, it feels like they've entered another universe. It's like they've disappeared in plain sight, is one of the ways that I've characterized it over the years. They've just kind of gone to outside of themselves. They become numb or hypersensitive or some combination therein, and they just kind of blank out for a period of time. That doesn't necessarily mean the Three Faces of Eve sort of drama of blanking out and becoming someone else, but that just means kind of either for a split second or longer, feeling like you're not really in the room, and the pain and the reminders are so overwhelming that you just kind of relive it in real time in a sensory flooding phenomenon. And that's very, very spooky. And that's one of the reasons that one of the first creative people to capture that phenomenon was Rod Serling, who wrote the scripts for The Twilight Zone, and not many people are aware of this, but he served as an airborne ranger in the South Pacific and had core symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder that haunted him through his life, including cigarette addiction, which killed him in his early 50s. So it's a powerful sequence of symptoms and events that really change cognition, thinking, interpersonal style, ability to feel safe. And another key symptom you see it when it's really flaring is hypervigilance. And hypervigilance feels like paranoia, but it's really not. It's really kind of this sense that you are being exposed to vulnerability, and sometimes minor cues will feel like a big deal. And the other odd paradox about PTSD is that people who have this are pretty darn good at handling crisis, but they're pretty terrible at handling day-to-day ordinary stuff. So it's a contradiction. There are many contradictions within the world of having PTSD, and I could certainly go on with many other examples of that, but, you know, this change in the way that you process events and thoughts and what is fearful and what is safe. So there's always this sense of danger is always looming, and yet there's this desire to seek out challenge or impossible odds, and you see that in some self-defeating relationship patterns and behaviors and cycles. Plus, we also see a tendency to try to make the feelings go away or disappear. And actually, one of the things that I've been talking about quite often now with some of the patients I work with is the instinct that seems to go along with active PTSD, and that is just leave me alone and let me think this through until I figure it out. And then when I figure it out, I'll come back to where I fit into the rest of the world. But I'd rather be someplace in rural Alaska or in my bunker, safe alone, and just I don't want to get near anybody until I've got this all figured out. And of course, this is something that defies cognition only. That's why cognitive approaches are not sufficient by themselves in most instances, except for lighter variants of PTSD. It requires a multidisciplinary, multidimensional sort of approach for the more complicated manifestations where it kind of digs in deeper and causes disruption in a multitude
now,
of dimensions.
I'm so used to talking about this.
You asked me a question, I could go on and on.
And I'll just interject when I need to because I'm thinking about our listeners, and our listeners have had major crises and, you know, may have some co-occurring disorders like drug or alcohol abuse, and maybe they've been horrifically abused most of their life, or maybe they've been through some sort of major trauma in their family where they saw their, a family member shoot another family member. So if they start experiencing some of those symptoms, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that they'll have this cognitive intrusion, and they may even feel like they're disassociating some. And give me two or three other, in simple terms, responses that they may be dealing with that says, I am not okay, and this requires the help of a specialist.
Well, a couple of the core symptoms, one of the hallmark symptoms is disruption in sleep. So, you know, there's this tendency to not be able to fall asleep or stay asleep. And very often there are intrusive nightmares that come and go, sometimes with triggers, sometimes without them. In addition, there's this tendency to want to isolate from other people or feeling like you're not good enough. Or conversely, there's this sense of superiority that no one can possibly understand me. So there are mixed signals that are sent out in terms of key relationships. It's like come here and stay away, that really puts this barrier between you and other people. And the three things that I always encourage people who develop PTSD to think about that are necessary in order to make progress, and this really gets into the core issues of co-occurring stuff, are the three S's: sleep, safety, sobriety. You cannot get well, you cannot get better with PTSD symptoms until you're in an environment that is safe. So if you're in an abusive relationship, you've got to literally disabuse yourself or get out of that relationship and get into a place of safety where you are able to, you know, detach and work through and heal and recover.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep is vital because if you're constantly sleep deprived, you can't really redo the injury that's done on a biological and a cognitive level in terms of brain chemistry and arousal patterns, which is also part of this. There's this hyper-startle, hyper-vigilant response. And as I mentioned earlier, this tendency to sometimes seek out intensity. It's hard to get away from that unless you start getting rest. So you need sleep and you need safety. And then, of course, sobriety. So many people with post-traumatic stress disorder, especially when it's active, use chemicals to self-medicate. They want to numb it out. They want to make it go away. They want to drink it away or drug it away until they forget. And that's a fantasy, of course, but it's a seductive one because temporarily, if you have a blackout or if you drink or drug enough, it makes you feel like, oh, gee, I'm done with it. But in actuality, what the using does is to deepen the injury, and it only numbs you temporarily and you find yourself in far worse shape. So the three S's are vital. You need sleep, safety, sobriety in order to really begin healing. And that's kind of what we look at in when this is active, how to kind of stop the crisis, how to create some traction so that people can start healing. Because this is difficult stuff to work with. And again, it's difficult to do this in isolation, and isolation is one of the instincts that people have. So they're in denial of their symptoms along with the co-occurring addictive disorder, and essentially they just kind of want to be left alone to, like, figure it out. And that's just, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, exactly. And so I would imagine that's what makes so many people with serious PTSD need to be in a residential treatment center or in a hospital setting to find the safety that they need, even if they're out of the abusive relationship, to find the safety to begin to work on some of these issues.
Yes, oftentimes that is necessary because it takes time out from all the distractions, intensity, or the sense of non-safety, and changing your environment can be a game changer. It saves lives, and it can help people detox from the chemicals as well as the emotional surges, and safety is important in that milieu, and that's what tends to happen, is that there's structure, consistency, and support that you can't get just staying where you're at. And again, cases differ. There are some individuals and some circumstances where you can achieve this on an outpatient level, but when the symptoms are powerful and unrelenting, sometimes there is no better choice than to go into a residential treatment program and afford yourself the time and the holding environment that permits people to work through the issues that are so powerful. But they can be really, we see a lot of tremendous changes. One of the fantasies that we see, the fantasy expectation, is that somehow we have in our toolkit a way of making it all go away. You know, the fantasy is make it like it never happened. And, of course, that's not realistic. And part of what you learn in whatever level of therapy or support or care that you're working with is that you learn to coexist with it. You learn to understand it. You learn to articulate it. And, in fact, one of the things that I try to encourage the clinicians as well as clients is you've got to learn how to explain this to other people, because if you can't do that well, and by explaining that, I don't mean at a full level, but at least being able to describe it in a way that interrupts power, because it is the mysticism of its power, the inability to articulate it, and its intrusive, almost demonic nature that really causes so much disruption. So increased clarity, and it's not just the understanding, it's the integration that occurs with finding a way to articulate it. You know, back in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, we overemphasized just finding words to describe it or words to express it. That's not alone sufficient, but it's part of the necessary set of skills that we try to develop so that the extraordinary becomes more ordinary and the intrusive nature of this becomes far less potent. And we see some amazing changes and amazing improvements. But again, we've got to have those shifts in behavior, starting off with sobriety, sleep, and safety. You can't treat this in a war zone.
Absolutely. And so at the Meadows, when a patient comes to the Meadows, they obviously are working with you individually. And do they work also in groups?
Actually, groups are extraordinarily helpful. It accelerates the healing process exponentially. And in the old days, we used to only think in terms of individual care because that was the original model of the analytic method. But in today's world, we see the combination of individual therapy and group therapies used judiciously as really accelerating the healing process, because there's something magical about hearing from another person the same sort of symptoms and dynamics that you're feeling. And when it's done in a constructive way, facilitated by skilled professionals, you're getting the sort of input that helps people become stronger as a unit and as survivors rather than feeling like victims. Because, you know, that's what a hallmark of a healthy group process is, finding strength and meaning from the misery. And a good individual and group therapy environment and a good treatment program will help empower, not just mirror or reflect. Our job is to help instill hope and instill strength, because some of the most incredibly strong people that you'll ever come across have really taken some pretty intense traumatic singular episodes or multiple episodes. And it's that transformation that makes them extraordinarily inspiring and helpful to others. And actually, that's part of the reason the group process works, is that you're not only being helped, you're helping someone else by explaining and understanding and dealing with the transformations that are necessary for you to find your balance again. And again, so the recovery process is not easy. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of strength and a lot of support, and it takes time. But it really gets accelerated when you're put in an environment where you can pull together the variety of tools and levels of care and skill sets to really accelerate the healing process.
Well, I would bet, and especially because so many of these people also may feel suicidal. And so, again, to find out that a lot of their feelings are normal within the context of what they've been through helps to not only normalize how they're feeling, but obviously to provide the support they need to keep working ahead and keep moving forward. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a matter of fact, the suicidal feelings are so common, it's one of the standard questions in assessing and doing screening for post-traumatic stress disorder in the veteran community. It's like, have you ever felt like hurting yourself? And you know, people who have PTSD almost invariably answer that, yes. I mean, people who don't have PTSD sometimes say the same thing. But it's one of those hallmark symptoms of hopelessness and futility and feeling like one wants to end it all. That being said, that doesn't necessarily mean that they become actively suicidal, but it's part of that ideation. And very often we see self-invalidating behavior, self-sabotage, that's most common. And the other thing that we see, which is sometimes under-articulated, we see the opposite. We see workaholism. We see people committed to mission and becoming numb by working too much. So work itself can become a quasi-drug, if you will, and it interferes with the balance that is necessary in order to make peace with all that inner chaos.
Well, that makes 100% sense. Now, if somebody believes that they might be suffering from PTSD, obviously you want them to have a treatment provider who's good at what they do or that has the program that's the right fit for them. So what should they look for in a treatment provider and a treatment program?
Well, I think important is finding a level of trust and trustworthiness in the individuals and in the systems, but not looking for perfection. It's a bit of a paradox because I think one of the resistance factors is I've got to find someone who completely understands me instantaneously, and that's a little bit hard to do. So one has to have some flexibility, but at the same time, have high standards. I mean, the person that you seek out and the program that you go to needs to have a clue as to what it feels like to be powerless and what it feels like to be, turned inside out and feeling without power or hope. So there needs to be a chemistry, a sense of trust, relative trust, because perfect trust is almost impossible when you've got active PTSD, and
right.
A sense that there is empathy without just empathy only, because you need strength from that institution or from that provider. You need encouragement and empathy, because empathy isn't enough and being told what to do isn't enough. You need a combination of the voices, and in a residential setting, you need different voices telling you different messages in a coherent way that is strengthening and validating. So, for example, in a place like the Meadows, one of the things that is necessary is to confront the addiction, but at the same time to the survivor. And that's a difficult thing to do when you've got two problems co-occurring, which is very common. You've got an addiction issue, which may be in early resolution or barely, being recognized and treated. And that behavior needs to be confronted in a constructive way, and at the same time, you need to be soothed as a survivor. So, and a good system knows how to orchestrate those voices so that they're empowering, not enabling, and not dismissive. Institutions and individual providers who don't do that find ways to blame the patient or the client, and that's something that should not be tolerated. By the same token, though, you need to, as a consumer, as a client, you need to be able to handle constructive, loving, tough love feedback from a provider who you trust, as well as the peer group that you can find power in that peer process as well.
Okay, and so obviously it's that delicate balance between the tough love approach as well as the caring, nurturing, connected relationship approach. So
right.
you, as somebody who has this disorder, you're going to be looking for somebody that you can absolutely trust, but you also know they're pushing you.
That's correct. That's
mm-hmm.
correct. And you also want to find levels of expertise and specialty experience. So
okay.
you want to have people who can do things that are known to help facilitate recovery and do specialty pieces, such as, you know, training you in mindfulness sorts of endeavors, certain forms of yoga, tai chi, somatosensory experiences, EMDR, things of this sort, when used in concert with a general environment that is containing, soothing, empowering, really help lift you to the next level. But using a technique in isolation as an outpatient and thinking one maneuver is going to fix all is oftentimes a setup for frustration. So it's a question of using specialized techniques along with the gestalt of a safe environment and a holding environment that gives you the mirroring feedback, the nurturing, and the tough love that you need in order to find sobriety and not engage in that self-invalidating pattern where you're blaming yourself secretly for everything and you're reliving, you're walking around living hell sort of thing with this unaddressable internal conflict that has no answer. So acceptance, the core things that we try to encourage, that I'm trying to encourage individually and in systems that I've worked with, is working
mm-hmm.
toward, and the 12 steps work toward the same goal. But it's even more difficult for people that are trauma survivors, and that is acceptance and forgiveness. But the forgiveness usually involves self-forgiveness for survivors because, ironically, even though they've been victimized by others, they take on the attribution that they're to blame for everything, don't you know? So I kind of view PTSD as kind of a variant of codependency on steroids, as well as kind of
mm-hmm.
spiritual crisis, thinking that they are responsible for what went wrong. And if you look at military units, the military helps train you to think that way because you're responsible for the life of your buddy. And if that buddy dies, it's your fault. So there's training that enhances that, as well as just this default that's within us that tells us to take care of other people and to take responsibility. When things go wrong and you feel bad about the outcome, there's this tendency to over-attribute control where you had no control. So forgiveness is part of that paradigm. Or forgetting yourself as well as sometimes working on forgiveness of the perpetrator in the situation. That's really, really tough stuff. So forgiveness and acceptance are really tough pieces of this work, but achievable in finding some meaning from the misery. And just to remind listeners of a very famous, very important quote from Viktor Frankl, who wrote about his experience going through the concentration camps. What we look for is a change in attitude. And his quote is, when everything around you is out of control, the only thing you can change is your attitude. And that's really what a good clinician and a good system and a good serious specialist helps the client do, is shift attitude so it's not all about me. It's self-blame, and also, ironically, I refer to the paradox. I didn't mention this before. One of the hallmark internal dynamics of PTSD, I call it shame-based arrogance, because simultaneously there's shame-based thinking that we see with a lot of addictive disorders. Don't you? If you got to know me, you would know how inadequate I am. But by the same
mm-hmm.
token, there is arrogance in saying that you have no idea what real trauma is like, so stay away from me because you're unworthy of my company or presence. So those two contradictory voices really shut out relationships, which are essential for sustenance in the human condition. I mean, we need support as well as food and air and water. And the final thing that I'll mention, and it's kind of inferred in what I'm saying, but it's certainly clear in what Viktor Frankl talks about, we need hope and meaning going forward. And that's not something that a provider can instill in you or a treatment program can instill in you, but it needs to be kind of inferred and part of that embedded environment. And that is, you know, we need to help empower people to find hope and meaning as they recover and heal. So it's kind of like a variant of the 12th step, except with some some specific dialogue that really addresses the inner turmoil and the inner struggles people with traumatic underpinnings have to deal with. So it's complicated. Here's the final paradox of it. The answer
is
fairly simple.
Yeah, then I
want to
ask you one question about this.
Sure.
This is fascinating.
Sure, sure.
Continue. Well, I was going to say, so, okay, obviously they need hope and meaning, and they need self-forgiveness and acceptance,
right.
and they need that support. This, you look at PTSD as a chronic and physical condition, correct?
Yes, correct.
So then
a chronic and physical condition.
Go ahead. Chronic and...
No, it's chronic and phasic. It comes and it goes. So even when you're better, it will get set off, but it need not set off crisis. So, you know, this is kind of the normalization of expectation that we try to encourage, that you're going to live with this, but it's not going to be a game-changing destroyer. It's something that can actually strengthen you over time, but you may have some bad days, kind of like being sober. You know, it's like every day is a challenge, but you get stronger over time, but not perfect. So the same is true with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it is, you know, it's a complicated condition that affects your biology as well as your outlook on the world, which is why it needs some address in terms of compensating for the biological factors, which doesn't necessarily only need medication. That's not the only path. There's nutrition, exercise, self-care. You know, I've always been a strong believer that people who deal well with this disorder become really well attuned to, I call it scrupulous self-care. They understand when they're out of balance, when they need to rest, they have to pace themselves, they nourish themselves well, they go to the gym, they do it. They do all the things that are necessary to keep their critical balance, and they know that if they miss a few things, that their thinking might change and they know how to correct it. So that's part of the skill set that we try to encourage in keeping balance. All that balance and integration, you know, I may be sounding a little bit fuzzy and new agey and talking about these general concepts, but it's a lot of hard work and a lot of steps pulling it together to find that balance and the forgiveness and the lifestyle and the structure that is necessary to contain the injury and find enough healing so that you keep in balance and stay integrated and on a path that is meaningful to you.
Okay, so then, being that it is chronic and phasic, it is something that can be managed. And
absolutely.
Having those life skills and utilizing all the resources to both prevent some of the onset or the triggers, as well as to keep it reduced to a manageable level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now... are there any books that you could recommend for our listeners who believe they may be suffering from post-traumatic stress?
Well, the most important book that I recommend for clinicians as well as people who have PTSD is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. There is nothing written that I've found that is more meaningful and inspiring than reading his book about what it takes to get through unmanageable, chaotic circumstances. So that's a very empowering, positive book to read. Another book that I would recommend is, and I didn't even get a chance to mention this, it's called Until Tuesday, which is a book about an Army captain who gets paired up with a service dog. And sometimes bonding with animals is a key toward safety and healing and recovery and getting better. So a lot of the younger veterans now are working with facilities and resources that help train service animals, and that's a game changer. So those are two books that are essential. And then for those who've been in combat experiences, What It's Like to Go to War is by Carl Marlantes is also a great book to read.
For you. Since this show is about sexual addiction, and we have a lot of veterans who describe post-traumatic stress, do you believe that they, too, oftentimes medicate with sexual addiction as if it was a drug or an alcohol?
Absolutely, yes. As a matter of fact, I've come across a disproportionate number of younger veterans and actually some older ones that have done that. And have gotten into sexualized acting out because it does numb you and it does create this obsessional distraction that gives you this illusion that everything is going to get better if I get enough or if I do enough. And it's acting out, and it's almost identical to all the other self-medicating, self-invalidating sorts of outlets that you could find. And there is an addictive pattern. And some soldiers, by the way, also have gotten exposed to pornography as a way, while in service, as a way of stress reducing, because there is some anxiety reducing component to that, just as there is of taking a drink. So it does some things in terms of re-regulating. It just doesn't do what we look for, because if it becomes any strategy that becomes excessive or addictive, keeps you off balance. And so, as I mentioned before, workaholism is another ism, if you will, another addiction that can also create symptoms and consequences. But there are a lot of pro-social rewards for that, at least in terms of monetary, but you're left alone. And I guess the same is true with sexual addiction. You're kind of have a lot of partners, but you're essentially isolated.
Absolutely. Well, this has been fascinating, and I truly believe that, we've been in war now for the last 30 years, more than we haven't, and so this is just epidemic, and I so appreciate your passion for this work. You do an excellent job. You came so highly recommended. Somebody wanted to check out the Meadows and find out the services, the treatment programs, the workshops that they have to offer, what would they need to do?
You know, you've caught me off guard. I don't have the 800 numbers memorized, but certainly going to the website and looking up the Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona is the first step. So, that's easy to do. Or if you go to my website, or I'm sure you'd have something posted on your show. But
absolutely.
Easy to find.
So, and so they can either go to the Meadows, which is www.meadows.com, or they can go to your website, which
I think it's meadows.org, if I'm not mistaken. But
you're exactly right, meadows.org.
Okay, good.
And then your website is?
jerryboriskin.com. And I'm also connected with the Meadows website. So either way, the resources are out there. Let me just put a words of encouragement in terms of finding resources. The tools and the providers are out there. We've become a lot more sophisticated. Clients need to be assertive and find the right place, the right providers, the right skills, and not become discouraged. This does take work. It takes quality providers, and it takes tenacity, but it does get a lot better. I wouldn't be doing this after 33 years of frontline work, and when I consider probably the hardest line of mental health that you can think of, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't find it personally rewarding and have seen some amazing changes, and I do all the time. So as hopeless as it might feel, there are skilled people, skilled programs, skilled providers that can help individuals get sober, get their lives balanced, and not become normal, because I'm not sure what that is, actually, but they become enhanced and strengthened survivors with a message. And to borrow again from Viktor Frankl, they can find meaning from their misery, and they become agents of support and become pillars of strength for others in helping individuals to heal from the all too frequent syndrome that we call post-traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic phenomena, whatever we want to call this, big T's, little T's. Things can get better with the right timing, the right tools, and the right support, and things really become vastly improved.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Boriskin, and I appreciate your feedback on this very important topic, and thanks to the Meadows, and you have a great week, and we'll look forward to chatting again.
Great, and if your listeners have any questions directed to me, they can email me at my website or just contact me via the Meadows. I'd be happy to confer, answer specific questions, but it's a privilege speaking about this. I love talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. You've done a very good job in permitting me to kind of hit the high points. It usually takes several hours to fully explain it to an audience of professionals, but I think we've done a pretty good introduction.
Absolutely, and thanks again for your passion, because you can feel it all the way in Indiana. So thank you so much, and we will.
Thank
we'll
you.
Talk
Take
to
it.
You soon.
All right. Thank you. Bye next.
fight. As you can see, he's very passionate. He knows his stuff. He's studied post-traumatic stress disorder for 30 years. I mean, how lucky is that, that we could have somebody on the show that has made it his passion and his mission to help this epidemic, people that have this kind of symptomatology can feel very immobilized by it. So feel free to email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. And if you think that you suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, you heard him say that sexual addiction is something that oftentimes medicates the tough feelings underneath this. And, you know, when we've got people that are experiencing cognitive intrusion, and that means that they can't keep the thoughts out of their head, and they tend to disassociate and go away from wherever they are, whether they're at work, with their families, with friends, when there are difficulties with sleep and safety and sobriety, that's the time when perhaps you need to contact the Meadows at www.meadows.org and look into what services they have available specifically for you. Okay, so next week we've got another riveting show. And I am so looking forward to working with Stuart Ball, who's going to be talking about addiction in general and how sexual addiction is fused with other addictions. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so I want you to fearlessly have the courage to be yourself and always remember there are resources available to you by listening to this show. I'll get you where you need to be. So don't give up, don't give in, and let's work this thing out together. You have a great week, and I'll see you next Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Sex Help with Carol the Coach.